This is the Mormon Expression Podcast. Find us on the web at mormonexpression.com.
Welcome to another edition of Mormon Expression. My name is Tom. I'm going to be your guest host today. Today's episode, we're going to be doing kind of a personal interview. There's a couple that I met about a year ago, Dennis and Sue, and they've been a host to couples and families and people that are reconsidering their positions in the church. They call it the call meetings or RTG meetings. And they've opened up their house to a lot of people that are reconsidering their faith. And that's where I first met Dennis and Sue. And the very first meeting that I came to in their home was where I heard Dennis and Sue's leave story. And Dennis had just read his story that he posted up on Post Mormon. And it was one of the most powerful and heart-wrenching stories I've ever heard. And I reached out to Dennis a few months ago, and I asked him if he'd be willing to come on and with his wife and talk about their story, and because I think it's a story that needs to be heard, and I think it's a very powerful and touching story. So that's why I brought him on. So welcome, Dennis and Sue.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tom. We're glad to be here.
So let's go ahead and get started. Let's start with you, Sue. Kind of give us a brief background and. Okay. You know, born and raised in the church and stuff like that.
Yes, I was. I was born into the church, and at the time, my dad was a bishop. He was under the stake president, Howard W. Hunter. He was bishop most of the time I was growing up. And I was one of those straight arrows through high school, college, and never wanted to do anything wrong, never questioned, just always wanted to do what was right, and had a relationship with my Heavenly Father. I had him constantly guiding me. And I was so grateful to be a member of the true church. And I couldn't believe how blessed I was to have that honor. And
So your dad was a bishop, and his stake president was Howard W. Hunter.
Yes.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah. Great man. He was a friend of the family, and we really loved him.
He almost married us.
Yeah, but he had to be out of the country at the time.
So. All right, how about you, Dennis? I know your story's a little bit different. You were a convert, right?
That's true. I was 18 years old, and had the missionaries come by my house when I wasn't there, and left a Joseph Smith pamphlet, and I started reading that, and I was impressed that I hadn't really had much of a religious upbringing to that point. So to hear a story about God speaking to a man again was exciting to me. I had a friend that was a Mormon. All I knew was that he was a Mormon, and so I asked him more about the story, and he says, well, I can have a couple of these young guys or a couple guys come and talk to you about it, about his church. And well, I was really excited. I was waiting for those guys in those suits and the big beards and the tall hats. And when those couple of young guys came to the door, I was really surprised. It wasn't what I expected. But they taught me the lessons, and probably a couple months later, I joined the church. And about a year later, I was a missionary. I was sent to the Denver, Colorado mission. That was in the early 70s. My mission president was G. Marion Hinckley, a cousin to President Hinckley. I had a great mission. You know, got to baptize a lot of people. It was the Denver area was growing by leaps and bounds. And we had I had a lot of great companions and some really neat stories. And So my life after that, I just came back to went back to California where I grew up. After my mission, came to BYU, met the girl of my dreams, and we were married in 76. And you know, I thought my whole life was set a course that I knew exactly where I was going and what I wanted to be. And we had four children.
You got married in the temple, right?
We were married in the temple, married in Los Angeles Temple. By what was his name?
Arthur Godfrey.
Arthur Godfrey, not the famous Arthur Godfrey, but the temple Arthur Godfrey. And so we were married by him, and we had everything figured out. We moved to Utah after that. I was served a lot of different callings in the church. I was an elders' quorum president a couple times. I was executive secretary to the bishop. I was a counselor to the bishop. We just had it all figured out. Then I got a job working for the church as a facility manager. We felt comfortable. We were on the right path. And then things happen.
So you work for the church. Did you? I guess I'm just assuming here, but I guess you had a strong enough testimony that you wanted to work for the church. Did you actually pursue that, or did they?
No, I did. Susan was actually one that told me when they were creating these facility manager jobs.
Because I was working for the church at the time.
Oh, you were?
I was working as a custodian. It worked out well because I could get my kids off to school, go clean, and get back before they got home. I did that for 8.5 years, and it was a great job. And I took it seriously. It was the Lord's church, chapel, and I wanted to do the best I could. I neglected to say that I'm a seventh generation Mormon. And on both sides of my mom and dad's lines, goes back to pioneer heritage, but one particular line of my mother's goes back seven generations to Ira Rice, who joined the church in 1840 and lived in Nauvoo. And,
from the very beginning.
Yeah. And left with the first group, but didn't come into Salt Lake with that first group because he stayed in Council Bluffs for a little while.
So you guys are married. You have married the temple, four kids. Life is great, and you guys are serving in the church.
You know, and when Susan told me about this job opening, when I applied, there were 300 other people that applied for the job I applied for, and I was lucky enough to get it. And it was a great job. I was really happy to get it. I had been in construction and in management most of my career. And so at age 40, when I got this job, I thought, man, this is great. This is what I'll do for the rest of my life, and just be a church employee and do my best. And it was great.
Did it make church more than just the religion and your faith? I mean, if you're working for them and then you're going to church on Sunday, that's like church.
Oh, I went to church every day. my office was in a church house. It was a bishop's office that they converted to a facility management office. And so it was going to church every day. I had no concept of Sunday church, because it was church. Every day was church to me.
Wow.
So, and we'd have even devotionals in our groups, with our employees. When I first started, we had 20-some employees in the group, and then they started sort of downsizing, and so we had a big, probably after I'd been there for a few years, we had a big downsizing, and we went from 20 employees probably down to 10, and then, of course, now it's down to just a couple, so
Wow. It
changed a lot, but I thought we had all the answers.
Okay, so you guys are full-fledged Mormons, right?
Living
the Mormon 100%. Family, and everything's going well until, I guess, lead up to us to around 2004, right?
It's 2004, but there were a couple things. As I look back, there was a couple things that I think sort of started making me think.
Right.
One was the Olympics, 2002 Olympics. All the church employees were asked to, everybody from Payson all the way to Ogden, were asked to help with the security of Temple Square and all the different other church sites downtown. So we were all given different assignments to, you know, the libraries or Temple Square or church office building to help with security and have people sort of direct people through the metal detectors and all that stuff. And one of the things we had to do is we had to go up to a training. You know, this was probably months or a month or two before the actual Olympics. And there we had these, you know, great big security. They also looked big to me for some reason, but the security guys for the church. They're, you know, and they're all, I guess they're all former police or FBI or something, but they have a lot of training. So they're the ones that were training us. And I remember specifically one night, they had probably 50, maybe 75 of us there together, and the security guy was telling us, he says, "Now, we need you to sort of come out of your Mormon selves a little bit to be security. Because, you know, as Mormons, we're a little bit more, we're subjective to, you know, of leadership, and we're passive and submissive, and we need to be, you need to be strong to stop people from not going through the machines right and stuff." And anyway, he used all these words that
don't be Christ-like in this thing.
Yeah, it was just words that it didn't make me feel very good. I mean, it felt me like a marshmallow that people could just push around and I'd do whatever they told me to do. And I remember that impacted me a lot. You know, like, wait a second, that's not who I think I am. That's just a mushball that can be pushed around. So it didn't make me. And so I think that was one of the things. And then I think the big thing, of course, I served in the National Guard, and I went to Kuwait for a year. And then, you know, that was a good experience. I got to see different religion, Muslim religion and things, a lot of nice people and a lot of nice people. But shortly after I got back, the big thing that started us really thinking was a talk our bishop gave. And he gave a talk, and he was talking about the point of the talk was obedience. And why don't you tell the rest of the story?
Well, the story was that he told us that Joseph Smith had gone to Heber C. Kimball and asked him if he could have his wife. And I think her name was Violet. And Heber C. Kimball, after several days of, you know, just distress, trying to decide what to tell Joseph, and he finally went to him and said, "Yes, Joseph, you can have my wife." And Joseph said, "Oh, well, I was just testing you." And our bishop said, "That is a great story of obedience." And I remember looking at some of my friends, several of the women in the congregation, we just looked at each other like, "What? What?" And I was primary president at the time, and I had met with him the week before, and he didn't get to talk because somebody went over, and he said, "I had something really important to tell." Apparently, that was the story he felt was so important to tell us. And I didn't even know what polyandry was, really. I really hadn't ever even we didn't know about it.
You know, I was shocked, too. I knew the bishop had just made a mistake. I had never heard that story, and I knew he had made a mistake. The logical thing was to go and find out the real facts of the story and try to set them straight, you know, in a nice way. We thought, well, we'll just go look up the story. And so we did, and that's when we started finding out that he was exactly right. And
were you guys living in Utah? Where were you guys living at?
We live in Utah County.
Yeah.
So when this happened, it was a bishop in a Utah County ward.
Yes.
Got up and said, Joseph was involved with polygamy and polyandry.
Yeah.
Yeah, he didn't use polyandry.
He didn't use that word.
Right.
But then we found out, and then I found out he really, okay, that was just a test. I thought, okay, so that was one time. But then we found out, no, it was many times, and he really actually did marry them. When I first read that he had sent men on missions so that he could marry their wives, I think I wanted to throw up. It just hit me so hard.
Yeah, and it was funny because Susan and I went along this path of studying, trying to understand what the bishop was talking about that day, I would all of a sudden leap ahead and say, boy, Susan, listen to this. I can't believe this stuff. And then she would say, oh, slow down. What are you talking about? You know, and she'd try to hold me back and say, oh, you're getting carried away. And then I'd say, oh, okay, you're right. And then all of a sudden she would go ahead and start saying stuff. And I'd say, no, wait, Susan, slow down. What are you doing? Where are you headed with this? And we sort of would hold each other back a little bit, and then we just kept going in the same direction.
Because once you start hearing it, I mean, it's like, I've heard it, the analogy of once the toothpaste is out of the tube, it's really hard to put it back in. And
well, you know, one thing with me is that when I got to that point, when I started seeing some of these things, I remember when I was on my mission, we were teaching a lay minister in the Catholic Church. And he when we started talking about apostasy, he told us, he says, okay, elders, I don't want to hear anything about apostasy from your Mormon books. I want you to show me apostasy from Catholic books. And so my commander and I said, okay, we'll do that. So we went and we found books, talked about apostasy from Catholic books, and he was pretty impressed. So my point is that I decided at that moment that I'm not going to because I'd heard about the anti-Mormon books out there and that they're all evil and terrible. So I said, I'm not going to believe anything anymore that I've been reading unless I can prove that they are from real Mormon books. And so that's what we use. So we use, you know, Journal of Discourses. We use the history, church official history books. And you use those as our guiding us instead of just anybody's opinion, because we didn't want to trust that. So we used the real books and we found the real stories that they were talking about, that as Mormons growing up, or as Susan grew up.
You're saying this wasn't on your mission, you're saying.
Yeah, this
now.
I mean, now all of a sudden these are things that I had never been taught.
No. And we weren't reading anti-Mormon literature.
Yeah, I wasn't anti, and that's when we learned what anti-Mormon literature was. It was the church books.
Well, you guys were in, you guys weren't just like living as Mormons. You guys were like in Mormonism. You were working for the church.
Mm-hmm. I was the primary president.
Yeah, your kids were all in it. I mean, it was a big part of your lives, if not one of the biggest part of your lives. I mean, yeah. So you're going through this conflicting period where you're starting to, you know, a few things are starting to cause you to scratch your head a little bit. So that led to one thing to another, right? And then you guys were going down the study.
It did, and we had, Susan had a friend that was down the street that also was, finding the same things, and so it was a.
We had someone to talk to, and
we could talk to and say, "Do you understand this? I mean, does this make any sense?"
But at this same time, our youngest son had decided that he wanted to go on a mission.
And this is when I was still in Kuwait. I was just getting ready to come home from Kuwait.
So in January of 2004, he decided he would get his life together. And so he went to the bishop, and everything was going along really good. And then one night he came home and told me that he had to wait a year. And I knew there's no way that he will wait a year.
You know, and before you tell that story, let's you know, Ryan, our son Ryan, was a great kid. I mean, this is a kid that, you know, grew up in Utah Valley. Everything to him was the church. I mean, every scout. I mean, I was a scout leader many times. We did all kinds of scouting things together. I think sixth grade that he decided to become a wrestler. So anyway, Ryan, you know, just had some great abilities as a wrestler. So he started wrestling in sixth grade, and we went to every wrestling tournament there was in Utah. And he just excelled. He was just a very sharp, enduring kid. I mean, this kid, he got awards when he got into high school for never missing a practice or never missing a tournament. I mean, they called it the Iron Man Award.
The Granite Award.
That's what it was. Got it 2 years in a row. Just a really determined boy. He always had to do the best and be the best. So when he was told he had to wait a year, before I could go on a mission, you know, it was pretty devastating to him.
Well, and he when he was trying to explain to me, he said, Mom, I wanted to go into the temple with nothing on my conscience, so I just laid it all out to the bishop. And I wanted to be totally, totally honest. And then that's when he was told he had to wait a year. And according to Ryan, there wasn't anything really that serious in my mind that he had done that he would have to wait a year. But because the bar had been raised and, you know.
Right. It wasn't that, you know.
They didn't take him to like a church court or anything.
No, they didn't do that.
They just
the bishop said, well, I need to put you on a year waiting.
Right.
He could still do everything in church. He just had to wait for a year.
Right. Yeah.
There wasn't anything, I mean.
And the bishop even told me when I got back, you know, from Kuwait, what had happened and why he did what he did. But Ryan was pretty devastated from that. I mean, it seemed like almost at that moment that, you know, Ryan changed.
Because he had been so honest.
So he knew his other friends. He had friends that lied, you know, and still went on missions and things.
Well, I'm sure that there's bishops that would probably say, you know, you go ahead. I don't know.
Sure. It depends
on the bishops. Every bishop's different.
And here I am. Dennis is in Kuwait. And I'm seeing Ryan was going down another path. And so I was just so happy that he was going to get ready to go on a mission. And so I went in and just said to the bishop, is there anything that can be done? And he said, don't worry. I'll go to bat for you. I'm going to go talk to the stake president. I'll go to bat for you. And I never heard back from him ever after that again.
So then Ryan, you know, Ryan at that point pretty much felt that, you know, he couldn't date Mormon girls anymore here in Utah County because he didn't, I sort of got the impression he just didn't feel that he was worthy enough of them anymore. And so
that's what kind of got him in trouble in the beginning.
Right. So he just didn't feel like he could date those Mormon girls anymore. So he you know, he got online. He met some girls online. He met a Mormon girl that was from Minnesota online. And a long story short, you know, he ended up marrying her. Probably a year later or so. Was it a year?
Yeah.
A year later. And of course,
is he how old now? 20, 21?
He was 21, maybe?
21.
He was 21. And so, you know, we didn't necessarily think it was the best thing, but he did marry her. We tried to support him, tried to do all we could to, you know, show him that we loved him, you know, that he was a good kid. But he could tell that he just wasn't the same after that. And by this time, too, you know, we're really feeling, you know, all this is going on, and we're feeling that the church has misled us.
Well, and I remember thinking, I have given and given and given to the church. I've given everything my whole life, and then they don't want my son. You know, and I understand that there's reasons not to send a boy on a mission, but it just didn't, I don't know, I just had this, you don't want my son. You'll take everything else from me, but you won't take my son and let him go on a mission. Something he wanted to do. He had tried to lay everything out, tried to be honest, and that was just a thought that kept coming to my mind.
You guys also found out that the bishop had kind of handled things a little inappropriately.
Right. I mean,
about two years later,
I mean, after the last bishop interview that Ryan had with the bishop, Ryan came to us and said, you know, I never told you what happened with that interview. And he told us that the bishop had asked some real intimate sexual questions to him that just really pretty much freaked him out. And he just was so embarrassed by the whole process. And the questions were so inappropriate, way over the line. You know, there's no justification whatsoever that you could ever think of that would justify those types of questions.
Like probing questions, like asking what you did, how you did it.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. those kind of things. And he just, like I said, that's the moment that changed Ryan, and he just felt so different. And then, you know, then it was probably, you know, that second year of marriage, that Ryan was second year of marriage.
Yeah. But it was after he told us that, we had started, you know, the bishop released me from primary presidency, and because one of my counselors had left and moved, and it was time. And but he called me in because I wasn't coming to church very much, but I had still had a calling in primary. And so he was keeping tabs on me, and all of a sudden I got released from this small little calling that I had in primary. I wanted to stay with the kids. I mean, I felt good in primary. And I remember he said to me, "Well, I released you. When you start coming to church more, then maybe I'll give you a calling." And I don't know. I thought, oh, yeah, that really makes me want to come back. And So there were several times that he had called me into his office. So on another later, after that experience, then he called me in again, and he was asking me, "Well, how's Ryan doing?" And I said, "You know, since you brought that up, I would like to ask you about this interview you had with him." And I said, "I understand you asked him some really intimate questions." And I started to say what those things were. And before I could even get it out of my mouth, he slammed his hand down on his desk, and he said, "That's a lie."
So he started to tell you that your son lied to you.
Yeah. And I said, "I believe my son." Three times I told him, "I believe my son. I believe my son." And he just said, "It's a lie. It's a lie." It wasn't... Here it was 2 years later, it was like, "You mean, do you..." You know, I thought maybe he would not even understand what was said, you know, and wait for me to clarify it. But before I could even clarify or go into detail, he slammed his hand down, and I knew I wasn't going to get anywhere. I just continually reiterated, I trust my son. I believe him."
It was shortly after this that Ryan, you know, I went to work for a company, and it was a construction company. He and during that construction, and also when we were snowmobiling one winter, he'd hurt his back, so he couldn't do construction for a little bit. So he came back from his work. He was working in Hawaii. He came back, stayed with us. By then, the marriage hadn't worked, and he was getting a divorce, or had gotten a divorce. So he came back and stayed with us. He was only here for a couple weeks, and because of a friend that had asked him to go bowling one night, I think he wanted to be with him so bad, he took some pain pills to get him through that experience. And with his other medication, so next morning, we found him almost dead. He was in a coma for 26 days, and then he died.
And I remember my good friend, and she was just being honest with me. I asked her, you know, "What are people in the ward saying?" You know, because we hadn't been going to church for a while, and she said, "Oh, it's being intimated that he didn't get better because we were inactive."
You know, and so here we were without a church. We'd lost our son. So we did the best we could. We had a funeral at the funeral home, and we conducted the funeral ourselves because we didn't have anybody else. Certainly the hardest thing we ever did. But we did it for Ryan because we knew that he wouldn't want to have it any other way. And we got home from the funeral.
Went out to get the mail.
We had an anonymous letter left in our mailbox that told us that we should become better Mormons.
You know how you should be living. And it was a note wrapped around an Articles of Faith card. And it said, carry this in your pocket so you'll know how to behave, act.
So that's what greeted us on our return from the cemetery.
Wow. So you guys had decided that, at kind of at that point when all this kind of happened, that you didn't... I mean, you guys were kind of going through a long separation of the church anyways.
And we decided before this that the church wasn't what it purported to be. We knew that.
For 4 years we'd been struggling with that before Ryan died.
So, I mean, this just...
it was just like, wow, how Christ-like was that? And not to say, there were many people that were very good to us. There were people from our ward that came and sat with us during the coma, when he was in the coma, because it was a long, hard time. And, there were good people. I love the community.
Was that bishop still bishop at this point?
Yes.
When Ryan passed?
Yeah, he did. And he did try to come and visit him at the hospital. And I sort of had to escort him out of the hospital because I wouldn't have him visit my son. I heard later that ward members had been told that I'd hit the bishop.
Like you punched him out,
huh? I punched him out, but of course that didn't happen. But
And I'm sure that there's people that think we were offended by him. But no, we had been offended already 4 years before when we started figuring out the truth of the history of the church. That's what offended us. And here we'd given.
In my my postings, I say that the church killed our son's spirit. It killed his desire. In the end, it killed him. I believe that. And since we've been on this journey, we've met so many people that have thought about leaving the church, that have left the church. You know, there's so many other terrible stories out there of gay men that have committed suicide, and there's a lot of pain. There's a lot of pain, and that's why we do what we do. We want people to know that you can get past, leaving the Mormon Church. That there are people out there that aren't going to judge you based on what you do or what you say you believe.
But not everybody that comes leaves.
Yeah, and that's okay.
And we're not there to tell them what to do.
No, we're not trying to deconvert anybody.
We're there to listen. Yeah. And cry with them and laugh with them and just give them a place.
So I want to go back to the funeral. Was there a lot of speculation that Ryan had killed himself?
There could have been, but he was in a coma for 26 weeks or 26 days. And it was an accident. I mean, in our minds, there's no doubt.
But
there were people, sure,
yes,
that probably thought that, he was on some anxiety medicine, and so...
And mixed with the pain.
And mixed with the he got a pain patch, is what he got, and he, you know, it wasn't prescribed. It was something that he found. He got a pain patch, and the combination of that and his other medicine that he was prescribed by a doctor is what you know, killed him. You know, he was an organ donor, and so there's four people out there that are alive because of Ryan. And
well, one thing I think we might have missed, you weren't still working with the church at the time, right?
No, I'd left probably a year before Ryan had died, and you know, I was working for the National Guard full time when all that happened.
Was that when you would finally stop working for the church? Was that kind of a moment where maybe you became less active? Kind of, oh, separation from the church really started to grow?
Yeah, well, by that time, yeah. I mean, I could, because before then, I mean, I needed to, you know, be a, you know, an active member to hold my church job. And, you know, I'd considered, you know, I mean, I know of others that stay employed, not believing, and, you know, hide it. And lie, but I couldn't do it. I mean, I just could not. Once I knew that it was no longer what it said it was, I could not stay, and I had to find other employment, which I did. But I could not stay. So, I'm glad I left.
So you guys, when Ryan passed, you say you did the services. Did the ward, that bishop, or anybody from the state come in and say, you know, we'll do this to kind of ease your burden, or was it just that you had refused?
No, I don't think anybody came to us. I think we just did it. I don't think anybody asked or offered. What's the report? I guess probably the report that I hit the bishop or something. They wouldn't even
which
approach
was not
us.
True.
Which was not true. But...
But there were many of our friends and ward members at the funeral, many that said that was one of the best funerals they'd ever been to, and because it was all totally focused on Ryan.
A lot of his friends spoke. I mean, a lot of his friends speak there and just told stories about his life. There wasn't any preaching. There wasn't any
There wasn't a whole lot of Mormon in it. Right?
There was none.
No.
There was none.
Because Ryan had not been active, he wouldn't have wanted.
No, and he'd been studying too. He'd learned the same things.
Since that pivotal interview for his mission and he got put on probation, he slowly started declining away from the church too, right?
Yeah, he did. And he was studying as well, and pretty much felt the same way as we did by the.
What about your other kids?
You know, we have three other children. Two do not attend, and one does. And the one that does has, you know, she has our love and blessings, and we don't try to deconvert her or tell her that she's wrong. If the church works for her, you know, we're happy for her. But she asks us questions. I mean, we'll tell her, but we're not going to go after her and try to tell her things that she doesn't want to hear.
You know, like, when I had heard your guys' story that first night, and Dennis, you had read your letter, and this, just the whole emotional trip of it all, I mean, now that it's 2010, you guys look back, how did you make it through all that?
It was tough, very tough. Yesterday was Ryan's birthday.
Oh, wow.
And
we spent it at the cemetery and at Happy Sumo, because that's where he always liked to go for his birthday dinner. And
he would have been 26 yesterday. He was 23 when he passed away.
We did find a community, a Christian church here in local, that we just kind of happened upon. And those people took us in with open arms. The pastor helped us through our first Christmas without Ryan. He was here in our home. And we had felt a lot of love from them, as we felt love from our ward members also. But it was just a good feeling.
I mean, it was it's a great little church. We go as often as we can, and it's a lot of nice people. And Scott McKinney's the pastor, and he's just a great guy, and really helped us. I mean, he's the one that really got us through that first year.
Yeah, that's an interesting aspect of all this, is that you guys were able to stay connected to some sort of religion, or at least a faith. Because a lot, you know, I guess it's fairly common that a lot of people, they go through this questioning period, they kind of give up on God altogether. And personally, I really admire that you guys have found a way to keep God in your life. Any tips? How did you guys do that?
Well, you know, like I said, I had, as a child, just such a great relationship with Heavenly Father. It was hard realizing, oh, he's not Mormon. But I think that he's still there and listening to me. A cousin that asked, you know, was asking us about our story, and I said, well, every time I prayed, it would just led me farther away from the church. And he was so shocked. He said, you prayed about this? And I thought, well, of course. I wouldn't make such a rash decision without praying, because I still believed in Heavenly Father and Jesus. And even more now, when you have a child die, you hope there is a God and a Savior and an after, you know, the afterlife. I just hope that I get to see Him again.
And we've had some experiences that tells us Ryan is there. You know, there is an afterlife, and we're grateful for those experiences. He hid Susan's glasses in the kitchen one day, so we're convinced it was him.
Well, we have had some spiritual experiences, which, you know, and that's the funny thing. You know, you think, oh, well, you leave Mormonism, you're not going to have any spiritual experiences. But I had some of the best spiritual experiences after deciding that Mormonism wasn't true. And so I can't deny that. I can't deny that. And it's been nice to be able to explore and find different ways of having spiritual experiences, and I really appreciate it. It's interesting to look at people and not go Mormon, non-Mormon, active, inactive. You can just look at them now and say humanity. They're people. We can accept all of them, and I don't have to.
And they don't have to look like us and act like us and be like us. They can be their own selves, and we can appreciate and enjoy that difference. And we have. We've met some great people the last few years, and they've supported. They've given us strength, you know. And we don't care if they're active or inactive or Mormon, it's just not important anymore.
So you can look past the labels, huh?
There's no more labels.
No more labels.
You know,
yeah.
There's just it's been the best, is to be able to
just see people for who they are.
Yeah, and you know, most of the common thread with all the people that have all the people that have come to, you know, our monthly meetings, gatherings, the one common thread that they all seem to share is that when some that have left Mormonism, they say that the freedom to think has been the most enlightening thing in their life. is that before they had such blinders on that they couldn't think outside, too far left, too far right. They had to look down this shaft, and all of a sudden they have the freedom of expanding their thoughts. It's just an overwhelming feeling for them, and they just have, all of them have had that sort of that common thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is one thing that I thought about as I've thought about your story. I can't imagine the angry feelings, the animosity that both of you probably had or maybe still have towards the church. You know, you'd mentioned that in a weird sort of indirect way, you kind of blamed the church for destroying Ryan's spirit and crushing him. Were you very angry?
Oh, we were. I mean, I think it's a grief process, because you've loved something all your life, or most of my adult life anyway, and all of a sudden that's taken from you, and it's a tremendous loss. And I went from great anger, and I suppose there's some that's still there, but most of it's gone, I think, now. And you just have to realize that, it is what it is, and you just have to move on. It's just people that, you know.
And I've gone back to church a few times since, just to see how I would feel, and because I miss sacrament, taking the sacrament and sacrament hymns. Music in the Christian church is a little different.
There's drums.
A lot different.
And guitars.
I missed that quiet, that, you know, I felt that was a spiritual time. And I visit teach. And I have visiting teachers come. Because I want to still feel like I'm doing something for somebody. Because I really do miss that part of it. And so I'm looking for any opportunity to help and serve. And so I have these older ladies that I've visited for a long time, so I still visit them. And they know I don't attend much, but and it's hard for Dennis to see me do that, because he'll say, how can you do that? Be part of a church that basically killed our son. And I guess that just shows the emotional ties that after growing up in the church, and for 48 years I truly believed and thought I was blessed, and I still can't quite let it go. I'll always be a Mormon, just if it's just culturally and not religiously, but I'll always be a Mormon because it's just part of me. And I mean, I figure we're all on our own journeys, and I guess each day I don't know where this journey is taking me. Sometimes I think maybe it'll bring me all the way back into Mormonism. I doubt that very seriously, but I don't know. There's been so many things in my life that I never expected. It wasn't the script that I wrote. And so, you know, I'm just open. I'm open to whatever Heavenly Father wants for me. God, whatever that supreme being is. I still like to call Him Heavenly Father. It makes me feel better.
You know, as I've gotten to know some of the people, you know, that you guys have invited into your homes and people that I've talked to, one of the things that I've never been able to quite portray is when faithful members of the church look at those of us that have gone through this sort of questioning, trying to reevaluate, trying to understand where they are with the relationship with their church, and they look at guys like me or people like you, and they look down like, you know, why did you do that? Why did you turn your back on it? And for me, it wasn't that way at all. It was, I don't know, it was inevitable, right? Because it's like what you were saying. So you were starting to be led down this path, and you had to let go of what the church gave you, which was certainty. The church gave you comfort. The church gave you answers. The church gives you all these things. And nobody, I don't think, in their right mind would let go of all that on purpose. Say, oh, I like everything the church gave me, and that's really nice and everything. I would rather not. I would rather go down a path of uncertainty, of not sure where I'm going. And that's always been a difficult thing for me to explain. Like, I didn't want to do that.
Bubble was burst, and I was angry about it for, you know.
Well, you know, I remember on my mission that I'd tell people, you know, this is either a great story or it's all bunk. And or it's a great spiritual experience or it's just not true. And I remember even in one of our meetings that I had, my companion and I went to, and we were teaching a lady, and her minister was there. And as soon as we walked in the room, the minister stands up and he pronounces, he says, I want to tell you Mormon missionaries that I can't believe Joseph Smith is greater than Christ. And of course I proceeded to tell him that that wasn't true. We didn't believe that Joseph Smith was greater than Christ. And then here, 30 some years later, I read a speech given by Joseph Smith where he proclaimed that he was greater than Christ. I felt like I wanted to go back and tell that minister, I'm sorry, you know, I was wrong. Mm-hmm. But it's just it was such a shock to have this experience and to lose your faith. I mean, it was, but we are grateful that we still believe in God and Jesus Christ. And that we're still believers in that part of it. And when we go to church now, that's what we hear. We hear about Jesus Christ. We don't hear about any other man.
You know, when I heard your story, and most people that have gone through the leave process, I mean, have you resigned officially?
Yeah, I've officially resigned.
And then Sue hasn't.
I haven't.
So when a lot of people share their leave stories and they talk about this, I think it's more than just a little bit of a wrench into it with your son. I think that's a little bit more of a factor and a little more telling of things. Do you think that, I guess it would be an obvious question, that episode with your son, how did that reshape your feelings towards the church nowadays? Does it change it at all?
I'll tell you that if I had it to do over, there's one thing I would, and I'll tell everyone, that I would never let a child be in a bishop's office alone.
We trusted the system. The system would be okay.
And I've thought about that now, and I've thought about, you know, Ryan, it took him 2 years to tell us what had happened. He was so traumatized by it. And it made me wonder what other things my kids had been told and how their self-esteem was affected. And
I had I had a fellow church employee tell me his story once that his neighbor's daughter, who was 16 or so, had been asked by their bishop if she'd ever had sex with animals. She lived on a farm, and that
sort of thing happened.
Yeah, and that family was so upset that they went to the stake president and said, you know, president, we're offended that the bishop would ask that question. And the stake president looked him right in the eye and said, the bishop can ask whatever he wants.
Anything.
So it's just frightening.
And so that was pretty frightening to.
So you know, I would probably, if I had it to do over, I'd say, well, that's fine, but I would like to be in the room.
And we advise our daughter that's active.
Yeah.
Never to allow that. And we hope she'll listen to us. We don't think anybody should.
Because when you trust a person so much, I mean, you know, you grow up, these people were called of God. And so the things you go in and tell them and they tell you, I mean, it's... it's everything. And unfortunately, a lot of it was very damaging, and we learned the hard way.
Since you talked about, you know, do-over moments, if you could go back, you know, John did an episode about mistakes were made, and you talked about listening to that. What advice would you give, or I guess if you could go back and change it, what things would you change, or what advice would you give to people that maybe in a similar circumstance that you guys went through?
That's a hard one. I think that the reason that so many people sought us out, you know, that have found us on the boards or whatever, is because they're looking for answers of how to deal with that. I mean, to answer that question, what do I do? I don't know if I have any advice. I wish the church would allow discussion. I think the church would, if the church allowed people to ask questions about, you know, translating the Book of Mormon into hat or the five versions of the first vision. I mean, if they could ask those kind of questions in church, I think that would be helpful, but I don't see that happening. I don't know what I'd do different.
I don't either. I just look at it as every day is a journey, and we make mistakes, but I think you just have to go with your gut feeling. I never, ever thought I would be in this situation, ever. But, you know, the spirit or whatever you want to call it guided me, and I just felt like I was doing the right thing. And I think everybody just has to go with that, with their own intuition. Does this feel right? Does this really feel like, you know, God's church? Would Christ act like this? And I would never want to tell anyone when they come. I don't want to tell them what to do. Some of them will be fine staying in the church. That's what works for them.
But some it doesn't work for.
Some it doesn't work for. And for us, I mean, it's just unbelievable that I'm at the stage where I am. And now I realize the older I get, the less I know. But that's okay. Every day's an adventure.
I mean, I get stupider when I get older.
Yeah, when you get our age, look out.
So what led you guys, this was a question that I don't think I've ever asked yet, what led you guys to want to meet people that have gone through the transition or they're going through? I mean, you guys opened your home up. That's a big thing.
Well, I think at first that we went to a meeting up in Salt Lake, which was our first experience, and so I was still a church employee at the time, and Susan was so afraid that someone was going to be out in the parking lot taking down license plate numbers, but it didn't happen, and we got to meet some really nice people up there that were saying, asking questions, and were like us, you know, just trying to figure things out. And and they could all speak openly, and nobody was judgmental, and nobody was critical of what was being said. And we noticed in that meeting there was quite a few people from Utah County, and so I don't know, something in there that, especially after Ryan, we just said, you know, if there's any way we can help the pain. We certainly filled our share. We wanted to help, and so we do. And every month, sometimes I think, well, if nobody shows up, I guess this will be the last month we'll do it. And then 20, 30 people show up, and so we just keep going. Every month I keep thinking that. I say, well, maybe no one's going to show up this time, and then that many people show up, and there's always new people every month. So, you know, until no one shows up, I guess we'll keep doing it.
Do you like to hear other people's stories, or do you, I like, just like this, us talking about all this, these very, very painful experiences, is it part of your healing process? Do you like to kind of relive that, or do you hate it? I don't know. Do you like to hear other people's?
Well, I don't know if I say a word like. I understand their stories. I understand the feelings they feel. I think Susan does too.
I do, and it does bring back some pain sometimes. But gosh, if we can just help them and talk to them and say, you know, you can get through this.
Well, we've had some really nice letters and things from people who have thanked us for doing it. And I said, we'll just, until no one shows up, we'll just keep doing it.
Has there been any stories or people that you've met that kind of give you strength or hope? Like, wow, if they can do that, because that's the way I see you guys, it gives me hope. So are there people that you have met that you're like, wow, I guess I can get through this?
You know, we have one friend that a couple that I look up to a lot that they've really helped I think formulate some of my thoughts and feelings about the way I look at the church and his acceptance of people, you know, give people a right to think and to think their own ways, and he's got family that. Children that are active, and he accepts them and loves them, and isn't out to deconvert them or anything. And I think he's the couple. They're the couple that have really helped us. I think Sue and I look up to them a lot. And one of them is Susan's best friend, one of her best friends, and they've been through a lot themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But they give us a lot of support and a lot of strength watching them.
Well, I guess we'll wrap this up. Maybe it's my little time to gloat a little bit. I've really come to love and admire you guys. You know, you guys let me into your house. I don't know why you do that.
We were worried. With your name.
Yeah, with my name. As long as I keep the L off, I'm okay. But I can't express how much I appreciate the example you guys set for being willing to share those painful experiences with us and with me. It really touched my heart. The first time that I'd heard your story, I went home trying to express the story that you'd shared, this story, with my wife, and I couldn't get through it. I guess that's what kind of bonds us a little bit.
True.
Yeah.
You know, when you meet people, and that's what's nice about these meetings, is you meet people that, I don't know, that you've gone to war with.
Right.
It kind of experienced stuff like that. So from the bottom of my heart, I appreciate both of you.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Tom.